Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's December 2023, and you're listening to episode 372, which is a conversation about the film Iron Claw and professional wrestling, and this film is in theaters now. On this episode, I'm joined by Cole Burgett, who is a graduate of Dallas Theological Seminary and the Moody Bible Institute. Cole teaches classes in Bible exposition and systematic theology, and he also writes extensively about theology and popular culture. Cole has written an online feature article for us. It is a review of the film The Iron Claw, and his article is called Painkiller, a review of The Iron Claw, and you can read it for free at our website, equip.org. Well, it's good to have Cole on 2 weeks in a row because we're getting to the holiday film season, and also the actor's strike is over and the writer's strike is over, so some of these pop culture vehicles like films are ramping back up, so we wanted to talk about a film that you can see in the theaters right now over the holiday season if you think it's appropriate for you. So Cole, it's good to have you on again, 2 weeks in a row.
Always good to be here. Thank you so much.
So I want to talk about this film. And first of all, I have to say that this is going to be spoiler filled. And also some of these events literally have happened more than 30 years ago. So it's the story's been out there. But I really want to give an overview of the story on which this film is based, because this is probably new to some of the younger generation, like millennials and Gen Z people who weren't around. They might have been barely born during the heyday of the setting of this, which is the world of wrestling and the Von Erichs family, which is well known in the history of professional wrestling. So what is this film about? What is The Iron Claw about?
Sure. So The Iron Claw follows this family that, call it a dynasty, if you will, of professional wrestlers from the area of Denton, Texas. I used to live in Dallas for a period of time. I went to Dallas Theological Seminary. So I know the area fairly well, and they're still very well known there. But this family that had the in-ring wrestling name of Von Erich, they were this really well-known family of professional wrestlers from that area that had huge success back in the 80s. And there's this particular move in wrestling or submission hold called the Iron Claw that the paterfamilias, if you will, this guy named Fritz, popularized, and his sons adopted, and they used in the 80s. And the family sort of has a, let's say, infamous reputation, because not only were they incredibly well known in the wrestling world, but there was a lot of stuff that went on outside of the wrestling world as well in their personal lives that led to just a lot of tragedy. Really, really sort of notorious in a way for this. And it sort of came to be known as the Von Erich curse. There's a lot of history to this family, a lot of tragedy. And the film sort of chronicles the life of one family member in particular. It's sort of told through his eyes. And this is the character that Zac Efron plays, Kevin Von Erich, who is the one who is still alive today. And you see the other family members in the film, but it's really a story that's told through Kevin's eyes. So that's a rough overview of what the film's about without getting too spoilery.
So, as I mentioned, this film is based on a real family and true events, and that this family was very involved and known in the world of professional wrestling. And so tell us a little bit about professional wrestling and just that whole scene and where the Von Erichs kind of place in that scene is, because I went into this film
knowing absolutely zero about professional wrestling. I mean, I knew it existed and that there's people like Hulk Hogan or Dwayne The Rock Johnson or whatever, but I didn't know. I mean, I knew they were in wrestling. I just didn't really know anything about professional wrestling. It just doesn't have any, you know, pull towards me, but it seems that it's obviously it's a very popular entertainment form. So can you give us a little bit more information just about that whole world?
Sure. So professional wrestling, it's an interesting beast. It's one of the more interesting beasts I've ever encountered in American culture, especially. But it's the best way I can describe this is it's a kind of theater. And it sort of revolves around combat. And the whole sort of premise that you buy into is the performers, the people in the ring, the wrestlers they're competitive, right? So there are all these storylines that spin out of this.
Is it like mixed martial arts or is it completely different?
I mean, it's I don't know how to answer that question. Some people are going to say it's very similar. Others are going to say it's very different. It's similar and different. It's similar in the sense that it's staged combat, staged in the sense of people sort of put the matches together and then the matches happen. It's different in the sense that the matches tend to be predetermined, that the outcomes of the matches tend to be predetermined, and there's more of a reliance on storyline. Storylines are typically, you know, generated around these conflicts between the wrestlers. And the difference between what's going on in, you know, the octagon of MMA and things like that is, you know, those are, you know, pretty serious competitive fights. The professional wrestling side of things is more showy. And there are storylines and there are good guys and bad guys. The good guys in the industry lingo, they're called faces, right? And then you have the villains who are called heels. So you have faces and heels. And the ring is sort of the main stage where these stories unfold. And when television came along, and this is the thing that most of us are going to be familiar with today, a guy named Vince McMahon sort of reshaped the industry using television. And so now you have today what is sort of popularly known as, you know, the modern wrestling show. The thing that you'll see on Monday nights or Friday nights on with WWE or like AEW that's now really big on TNT. All of these, it's almost like reality television where there are additional scenes that may be recorded backstage and sort of all stitched together to create a show that you put on television screens. But you can still go to the live shows. Many people do. And that's sort of just a very loose overview of the world of professional wrestling. It's a job just like anything else, but it's just a very different kind of job than I think what most people are used to. Now, the way that the Von Erich family fits into this, the Von Erichs were, again, this whole family back in the 80s of professional wrestlers. And they really came to prominence through the likes of Fritz Von Erich, Kevin Von Erich, David Von Erich, these people who appear in the movie. And during the 1980s, as television became more and more popular as a means of doing this, there was a lot of conflict between the territories, so to speak. So just to back up a little bit and explain that. In the world of professional wrestling, before something like WWE, which used to be known as WWF, right? And this is anyone over a certain age, like you said, will know, like the Hulk Hogan, the Stone Cold Steve Austin's, The Rock, you know, that was, you know, what they called the Attitude Era. When Vince McMahon and WWF was sort of in its heyday and WCW and the Monday Night Wars and all of that stuff. But before that, right on the cusp of that was when we're talking about the Von Erichs really gaining popularity. the way that the world of professional wrestling worked was it had territories. And it all was sort of birthed out of the old carnivals, right? That's where professional wrestling got its start, was as these kinds of shows that were staged and put on in these old traveling carnivals way back in the early 20th century. But as television became prominent in the sport itself, to the degree that one can call it that, there's a lot of debate over that. But wrestling itself, there were territories across the country. And each territory sort of did its own thing with its own roster of wrestlers, and you didn't really cross territorial lines. When television came along and people like Vince McMahon capitalized on that and Eric Bischoff capitalized on that, it changed the format of the wrestling game. And the Von Erichs were really popular right around this period of time, just as things were starting to change. They were really well known. And of course, what happens is a string of personal tragedies that sort of one by one takes them out, leaving only Kevin. It's worth pointing out, though, that the Von Erichs have children. You don't see a lot of these children in the film, but they had children who have gone on to still be in the wrestling business today. So there actually is a, I guess what you'd call like a third generation of Von Erichs that are still in wrestling. Ross Von Erich and Marshall Von Erich are contracted with Major League Wrestling today. And then there's Lacey Von Erich, who was with TNA. So they're still involved. This family is still ongoing, and it just has a very sort of revered place in the professional wrestling world.
You know, this film is about wrestling, and a lot of people, maybe if I didn't know we were doing a podcast on it, would say, why would I even watch this film as a Christian? It seems like professional wrestling is violent. And so why should Christians even care about this film or, you know, even note it at all?
So the first thing I would say about this movie is that as much as wrestling is portrayed in the film, this is not a movie about wrestling. This is a film about, in particularly, Kevin Von Erich. The themes at work in the movie, fatherhood, brotherhood, are really sort of important. And more than that, there's talk throughout the film about God. And it makes sense because the family is sort of well known for being, you know, at least claiming Christianity. And a lot of the funerals and that kind of a thing have been held at First Baptist in Dallas, which is a very big and well-known church in that area. So there's a certain kind of religiosity to the family and the proceedings of the movie that is very key. And where I think the Christian can really get their hands on this film is anyone who has ever grown up or been familiar with that sort of down-home Southern brand of Christianity, even a kind of Southern Baptist type. I grew up, my own background, in a kind of fundamentalism that can redefine your categories of what fundamentalism is. I call myself a happy fundamentalist, but the truth is what I grew up in was something completely different and not always for the best. But there's a lot of similarities in this family, at least the way it's portrayed in this film, what I grew up in, the way that I still see my family conducting itself. The old adage holds true that the child takes their view of God first and foremost from the parents, primarily the father. Then this film in particular shows what happens when God is a monster, and not the kind of monster we traditionally would associate with an abusive household. You know, there's no physical violence, there's no physical abuse, but there is a very subtle, very sinister emotional manipulation. There is this very sort of sinister, has the appearance of being sweet, has the appearance of being very sentimental, growing into being, 30, 40 years old, and, still just having that soft spot for daddy and mommy and that kind of a thing, which isn't necessarily wrong on its face. But here the parents emotionally stunt the children. You could even say spiritually stunt the children. And it all sort of conflates with these personal tragedies to really make one question. What is God doing, not just in the world, but in my life? How do you deal with tragedy? How do you deal with emotions? Especially when you have no emotions, and yet everything sort of has this cloying sentimental kind of emotional sheen to it, which is what you're dealing with here and is the kind of thing that I grew up in. So I do think this is a film that Christians can very, very powerfully speak to, can really grasp. As we've said on this podcast before, the Christian should be the most clear-eyed person on the face of the planet. It is unfortunate that that is usually not the case. The Christian should be the most self-aware person. It is unfortunate that in the modern American church, that is usually not the case. This film makes a very good case for why you should be. I'll put it that way.
Well, 2023 is winding down, and there's literally only a few days left. And I know some of you are still thinking about some of the year-end giving you're going to do by December 31st. And we would ask that you would prayerfully consider making the Christian Research Journal part of that year-end giving that you are going to be doing in the next few days. And a way that you can give us a partnering gift is to go to our website, equip.org. Scroll down to gifts for your donation, and you'll see there a picture of the journal, our very last print issue, which had a special theme, the War on Western Civilization. And for your partner and gift, you can receive a copy of this last issue, which is a collector's edition. For your gift, you can get one copy, two, four, seven, or even 10 copies for your partnering donation, and we would be so grateful for that. If you would rather receive, as our thank you, a gift from one of our contributors from the Christian Research Journal, in that same section there, we have four different books from our contributors that we're offering for you to get as a thank you for your partnering gift. A new book by longtime contributor Doug Groteis, The World Religion in World Religions in Seven Sentences. We also have some selections from Mama Bear Apologetics. We have two books from them. And then we also have a book about Mormonism, responding to the Mormon missionary message. And back in September, we had the authors on, Corey Miller and Ross Anderson, and you can look for that podcast if you haven't already heard it. So thank you so much for considering giving us a year-end gift in the next few days. We are very grateful, and you can do that at equip.org.
I want to go back a little bit and just, you kind of gave an overview of professional wrestling, but it seems to me that while to me, I'm not interested in professional wrestling, there are a lot of Christians that are interested in professional wrestling. And so it's a very popular sport, but why do you think so many Christians are interested in it?
Yeah. So particularly Christians with professional wrestling, to put my own background back into this a little bit, my grandmother, my dad's mom, never missed a Sunday in church. She also never missed Friday Night SmackDown. it's one of those sort of quirky things in my life where before she died, she loved wrestling. Very committed Christian, very much into wrestling. And I've sort of always wondered that, why, what kept her glued to the screen. And I have theories about this, but my grandmother was a simple person. You know, she died without ever seeing an ocean, which is one of my regrets. She never really traveled outside the borders of the Kentucky, West Virginia area, except to go to Ohio to visit her sister. For her, wrestling was a kind of blue-collar mythology. She took it with the seriousness that people today take superhero movies. You couldn't interest her in, you know, a Spider-Man movie, but she watched her Monday Night Raw type thing. And I think wrestling, professional wrestling, occupies a very interesting place in modern American culture. I think it has this sort of luxury of being analog entertainment in the digital age. And it people still turn up for it. And it's a kind of very unique American mythology that people gravitate toward. Now, that's me looking at it from the perspective of why I think people watch it, even Christians, because we are people that love stories. But from an industry perspective, to the degree that I know a little bit about it and have sort of seen behind the curtain, there are a lot of professional wrestlers that are professing Christians. The Von Erichs come to mind. More popularly, somebody like Shawn Michaels, who's very well known. A lot of these characters are, let's say, conservatives. And I'm not painting with a broad brush here. There's obviously diversity in wrestling. But a lot of those people who very much on the rise of mainstream wrestling in the 80s, 85, in that era, and into the 90s, the Attitude Era. Those people, even though they portrayed heels on television, either became Christians or were Christians behind the scenes and have always had this, they've always sort of been flirting with God, if you know what I mean. And there's been a lot of books written and documentaries released on that particular subject. So that being said, there has always been a kind of strong corollary between professional wrestling, American mythology, and Christianity. And as we all know, Christianity, even in an America that looks very different, is nonetheless a very key part of America's history. The Christian ideals, if you will, are things that form the bedrock of a lot of American ideals. Now, the degree to which those are actually biblical is another discussion entirely. But from a superficial perspective, it all coalesces and it all sort of fits. And that's where I think a lot of the interest comes from.
Well, it's interesting. You said earlier in the podcast that this is, in other words, MMA is actually, yes, there's some showmanship, but it's a professional sport. Not that pro wrestling is not a professional sport, but there is this kind of theater to it. And so when you see the movie, you realize, well, there, when he's explaining, when Eric is explaining to his girlfriend what it is, he said, well, some of this is kind of prearranged. It's a business. And so some of it's not really a match. I mean, they decide who wins the matches. And so there's this sense in which it's kind of like fake. It's not really real. It's not like boxing, for instance. Yes, there are kind of different feuds in boxing, but it's an actual like Olympic sport. You know what I mean? So how does this, I mean, it definitely in the movie, it showed that there was different feuds, but also in pro wrestling. I mean, I earlier named the only thing I knew about pro wrestling was people's like names, like Hulk Hogan. I have no idea what his real name is, but I think now because Dwayne Johnson used his wrestling name to transition into acting, most people know him as The Rock, even if they didn't know he was a pro wrestler. So is this part of the appeal, is that it's this showy kind of fake acting?
So I actually think, to answer this question of wrestling being fake, if I just sort of step back and you just bear with me for a second, and I kind of walk you through a little more detailed overview of wrestling. I know I sort of gave a very condensed one at the start, but I think it will help to sort of explain where this weird sort of, it's real in the sense that they're doing it, but it's fake in the sense that they're not actually killing each other type thing. It'll make more sense. So professional wrestling originated in parts of Europe and North America in the 19th century, primarily from something called catch wrestling. Catch wrestling is a particular style that combined grappling and ground fighting. It's very popular in the West. Wrestlers, or what we think of as professional wrestlers, performed in carnivals at the time. So the whole idea of like wrestlers in tights and that kind of thing and very colorful costumes, it's all sort of vestiges from that sort of weird subculture that was popular over a century ago. So they performed in carnivals. They would, you know, these sort of legendary strongman characters. And the matches were usually kind of rigged. And it was rigged to get people's money, right? You wanted people to come to see if, you know, such and such could beat the strongman, the legendary strongman, or the guy that we all know doesn't get beaten. And so the matches were sort of rigged in these carnivals with predetermined outcomes for the purpose of entertaining audiences and to keep them coming back for more. So I think when someone says, well, wrestling is fake, well, it depends on what you mean by fake. Is it fake in the sense that they're not, they're actually trying to kill each other? No, it's the opposite. When you're in the wrestling ring, what you do is you try to actually protect the other guy. You execute these, you know, acrobatic things, these sort of wrestling techniques, but you do it to try and not hurt the other dude. So, you know, decide which takes more skill. Doing these things and trying to not hurt someone, or doing these things and you know, actually trying to hurt someone. That's sort of the idea. No one's going to debate that those aren't real people out there doing real acrobatic things. But the degree to which they're actually trying to hurt someone is different. And that's not really the case. It's a show. It's a kind of theater. And it's rooted in the carnivals. Now, when television came along in the, let's say, the 1940s through the 1960s, let's just go broad. When television came along, wrestling gained popularity. Shows were broadcast live and drew larger audiences. Now, regional promotions began to pop up. So this is the territories thing I had mentioned before. The sport was organized into regional territories, each with its own promotion, champions, style, that sort of a thing. This is where figures, you know, if anybody's listening and know these names, Gorgeous George, Bruno Sammartino, those characters came up around this time and became household names. Now, when you get to the 70s and 80s, that is when promotions like the World Wrestling Federation, WWF, and NWA began to dominate, and they began to break the regional territory system. This is where Vince McMahon, sort of using television to his advantage, began to sort of invade the promotions, the territories, if you will, and buy out the promotions, began to consolidate power. The moment that marks this was in 1985 with the launch of WrestleMania, this marquee annual event that becomes this cultural phenomenon, right? WrestleMania is the show, the wrestling show to go to. This is where wrestlers like Hulk Hogan, Ric Flair, who is actually in the Iron Claw, he's in there, played by a guy named Eisenberg, not Jesse Eisenberg, but he's actually portrayed in the film. And someone named Andre the Giant, those characters become superstars. Move into the 1990s, the Attitude Era, that's where you get Stone Cold Steve Austin, The Rock, those characters. And then really after that, you've gone through a few different eras of WWE now. And there are a lot of smaller promotions out there. But that's the sort of the condensed history of the thing. So when someone says, and you'll hear this all the time, well, wrestling is fake. It depends on what you mean by fake. Those are real guys doing real stunts, in a lot of ways doing real acting, which is why so many of them, John Cena, The Rock, Adam Copeland, Chris Jericho in a lot of ways, Chavo Guerrero, they all make the sort of the leap into the realm of Hollywood because it is a kind of theater. So it's fake to a degree, but I would say it's actually very, very real in a lot of ways. It's a business. It's entertainment. And in that respect, it's a thing. Now, I will say this. Taking a bump, which is what is known as hitting the mat or landing on your back, you know, the thing that makes the ring pop and you hear the sound and that kind of a thing. There are some people I know who are, they're MMA guys, put it that way, who have taken bumps to try it out and have said, I would never do that with my life. not a chance. Because it hurts and, you know, it's not killing you. But injuries are common. Injuries are common in this world. So, and I actually think there's the scene in The Iron Claw. You see when David gets injured, he literally just lands the wrong way. I think he hurts his shoulder and the way it's portrayed in the film. And suddenly he's out. You know, that's common. Injuries are common. So I just would say when someone says wrestling is fake, just be sure to nuance that word fake and clarify what is meant. So it's real people doing real things, just maybe not what it looks like at face value.
So I want to kind of delve into the movie more specifically right now. And you said earlier in the podcast that this is really not a film about wrestling, although that's kind of the, you know, subject matter in which it takes place or the circumstances, but it's more about this particular family. And one thing you did note is that some wrestlers are Christians, and it opens up with some talk about their family and God and fate and curses. Especially their family was just full of tragedy. Again, this is going to be a big spoiler. It seems that they had an inordinate amount of just very serious suffering, tragedy, and death. So do you think there's a lot of theology in this film?
Yeah, I do think theology is all over this movie. And it's worth saying that this film is not a traditional, like, biographical sports movie. You know, it's not even a traditional sports movie. I think watching maybe some of the trailers, you might think, well, this kind of looks like the professional wrestling version of Rocky or Creed. It is not that at all. It's the word that comes to mind when I think of this film is melancholy. It's a melancholic film. It's a drama. It's a drama through and through. The wrestling scenes in terms of runtime are short. There's actually not that many in the movie, even though it's sort of there in the backdrop. But the film itself is the kind of movie that's aiming more for awards and not just to entertain. The Iron Claw is, I would say it's not so much a movie about faith or theology or anything like that, but I do think it is theological. There was one review I read, I thought it said it extremely well. It's not so much a film about faith as it is a film about the need for faith, which I think is very sort of true. There's, just to get into spoiler territory because it's going to be impossible to talk about this without doing it. The Von Erich family experiences accidental deaths, suicides, and not all of the things that were actually experienced by them are shown in the film. The film is showing a very sort of streamlined version of a lot of these events, which is really sort of shocking when you watch the movie, because the brothers just die one after the other, kind of thing. And there were deaths that weren't even shown, and one of them is completely excluded, which it was said that this was done for the purpose of time, which makes sense because you're trying to condense all of this into a 2-hour film. But there are shots of it's like a crucifix, which we talked before. This is sort of hilarious that, you know, it's a crucifix because they're supposed to be Baptist, but whatever. That sort of bookend the movie, and the Von Erich matriarch's faith. Faith in God sort of is a through line throughout the film. And here you have Kevin Von Erich, who has sort of been brought up under his father to be like the real, you know, masculine idea, the real man's man. You don't cry, you know, sons aren't supposed to see their father cry. They're never supposed to see their father weak type idea. And you basically chart this very closed off and emotionally remote human beings walk through tragedy after tragedy after tragedy after tragedy, and seeing that it's slowly breaking him down. So the movie is theological in the sense of it really shows the need for faith. It shows the cost of this sort of, it really, it's a kind of sentimentality, this whole, you know, braggadocio masculine thing that you're trying to get your arms around while watching this movie. It really shows the toll that takes on a human being, who isn't self-aware, who sort of cruises through tragedy, because, you know, you can't show weakness. You have to just roll with the punches. You have to take it in stride. And, you know, you've got a strong father behind you, and you've got Jesus behind you, and this is, you know, what a man is. Those ideas. You sort of chart the breaking down of that facade in Zac Efron's portrayal of Kevin Von Erich, which I think is very, very profound. It's important, and it's especially important for Christians today, and especially in the context of American Christianity, where I do sort of think the great threat to the church today is sentimentality. It's this this cloying, unrealistic version of the Christian life that says, you know, everything's just going to be all right because, you know, God loves me, and I'm going to love everyone, love the whole world in a way that's just unrealistic. It doesn't make room for suffering. It doesn't make room for struggling. And in very much the same way, Kevin Von Erich, as he's portrayed in the film, doesn't have a category for this, doesn't have a category for suffering and dealing with trauma. And so there's this, there's one way to look at this film where the talk of God is there and sort of bookends the movie, where it's not really a film about faith, but it is a film that sort of postulates all these tragedies that befall this family. You can easily see how someone looks at it and says, well, if God is there, then God is a monster. But at the same time, realizing that the view of God that the Von Erichs have is that of their father, is that of Fritz. And the movie is sort of Kevin's coming out from under that, so that when he finally has his confrontation with the father there, the end, which as far as I know is apocryphal. Those of you who end up watching the movie, you'll know what I'm talking about. I don't particularly want to spoil this one, but as far as my understanding of the events is, Kevin was never there when Carrie is found. It was the father who found him, but the way the film does it is Kevin and Fritz sort of discover him together and they sort of have it out, and it's a catharsis moment. And I think the film is very theological in that respect, and it's worth paying attention to.
In the context of the film and this theme throughout, specifically of family, particularly about fathers and sons, and very much so about brotherhood, is, and like you said, the bookends of, you know, their mother's faith helped them try to explain some of these tragedies that would befall them. It has this underlying, without talking about how Christianity impacted their lives, displaying of it. So I really wanted to ask you if you think that the film captured the events of the real Von Erich story, because in it, so many times over and over, you see the various different sons have gifts in other areas, not wrestling, but the family business, so to speak, comes above their own interests, what they might have done in life instead. And it's interesting to me because that kind of has that echoes of honor your father and mother. So when the dad asks one of the sons after, you know, a door closes on another profession he might have had pursued, even in sports, you know, he says, you know, son, come into wrestling with us. And the answer is, yes, sir, I'll do it. And kind of the idea of honoring your father, because that's what God would want you to do. It seems to me those kinds of things are woven into the story. And so how well does this film really capture what happened?
Yeah, I'll say it this way. I think the film does a remarkable job of capturing that particular culture, that subculture that you're talking about. Again, it's something that I grew up in, and it's a very difficult beast to put a face on. But it is there, and when you see it, you know it. And I saw it all over this film. As far as the accuracy of the events, I mean, it's worth pointing out that Kevin Von Erich has endorsed the portrayal. He actually said in one of the interviews I read that the film really sort of accurately portrays his father and how his father was. That being said, and I think I mentioned this earlier, the film doesn't really even show all that was going on. I mean, the film is following Kevin's perspective, and it shows the major beats, that sort of the things that are most well known. But I mean, there were other deaths. There was, like I said, a brother who died that really didn't even get any screen time. There was a younger brother who died as a child that the film references, but isn't even really there, save for one sort of scene there towards the end. One of the brothers had a kid who died. I mean, it was just, I mean, it's, if you watch the film and come out thinking this is too much, it's actually not enough. If you want the truth, it's actually not all that this family went through. So in that sense, do I think it's accurate? Yeah, to a degree. But I think the more frightening realization is that there was a lot more that went on behind the scenes. It's also worth saying that Kevin Von Erich, this was an interview I read he gave back in February, I think with Slam Wrestling is where it was, where, you know, he straight up says, you know, he's actually talking about Carrie, his brother. He's remembering his brother, and he points out that he himself is a Christian. He raises his family to be Christian, and he actually made the profound point where he says, I'm not afraid of death, and that must just be the difference in a Christian and other people. which I think is actually, it sounds a little Pauline in a little words. It sounds a little lot like Paul. But Kevin has endorsed the film, and particularly the portrayal of his father. And so I think that's probably the best endorsement you can have from the guy that the movie's about.
And what do you think this movie says about God and the belief in God and who God is and suffering? Because it almost seems like, you said, you see this film and you kind of say, did Hollywood write this? I mean, this brother committed suicide, then this other brother committed suicide, and this brother died. I mean, you kind of start thinking, is this what? I mean, it makes you go to Wikipedia for sure at the end to say, is this actually true? Because it said inspired by true events. But what does it really say about suffering and God, and how can Christians kind of engage in that conversation with people because of this film, because wrestling is so huge? And I think for a younger generation, maybe they're into the more newer, you know, kind of iterations of pro wrestling, as opposed to when it was really getting its start, you know, in the TV era in the 80s, and you mentioned Vince McMahon and so forth, because they would say, well, wouldn't you question God's existence? Now, you just mentioned that Kevin considers himself a Christian, and yet, so, you know, that's part of their, I don't know, their mythology is the Von Erich curse, because all this stuff happened to them. So what does that say about God?
Yeah, I think those are all questions that the film sort of has in there in an underlying sense. The question of faith that runs through the movie is so muddied by the dysfunction of the family. Which I think is such, that's where the film becomes really realistic, right? I mean, yeah, it's all of these insanely tragic events that seems like something out of a Hollywood movie, when the truth is, you know, the actual thing was much stranger than what's in the film. But this, the question of faith being muddied by family dysfunction is something that so many people can relate to. And I do think anyone who has been a Christian for more than 2 weeks has that moment where they sort of look back on their own life and have questions. And I think Christianity has been so, how do I want to say this? Christianity has been so emasculated, has been so defanged, declawed, that the only kind of God we can conceive of, or even more specifically, a Jesus we can conceive of, is a Jesus who suffered so that we don't have to. When the truth is, when you read Paul and practically every letter he wrote, when you read Peter and his encouragement to his readers, when you read the letters of John in the New Testament, these early Christian figures, suffering this side of eternity, unbearable suffering, is a guarantee. There's a real sense in which, you know, the one absolute guarantee the Bible gives you is that you're going to die. The difference is, with Christ, there is a caveat to that, which is that you don't stay dead. And that's really what Kevin was talking about in that interview, and saying, you know, he doesn't really fear death. There is something that comes next, and he's right. That is the difference between a Christian and someone who isn't. So I think the film doesn't get into this stuff overtly. It approaches it from a much more, let's say, humanist perspective. But what it does do is allow you to empathize, which is a profoundly Christian notion. Watching what the family goes through, and understanding that even if, you know, our family dysfunction doesn't run as deep as that, there's a lot of dysfunction in a lot of families. And even the most unlovable people can find some sympathy, or should find some sympathy with the Christian. And I think framing suffering, as you said, so many people can look at the issue of suffering and say, well, you know, how can there be a God? Well, nowhere in Scripture are we ever given this indication. No, literally nowhere in Scripture are we ever given this indication that God and suffering don't exist on the same playing field, put it that way. What tends to happen, and this is what makes Yahweh as a, let's say, as I'll use the word character, this is what makes Yahweh as a biblical character so fascinating, is that he works through it. You see this with Joseph in Genesis, which really becomes the resounding theme across all of Scripture. Paul picks up on this in Romans to describe what happens with Israel and the Gentiles. After all the nonsense and the shenanigans and the immense suffering that Joseph goes, wrong suffering, by the way, wrong suffering that he goes through, there's suffering that, you know, happens as a result of what someone does, and then there's, you know, suffering that's just foisted upon you unjustly, and Joseph is the prime example of that. When his brothers finally reunite with him, he tells them, what you intended for evil, God intended for good. It doesn't negate the fact that what they did was wrong. It doesn't even negate the fact that what they did was evil. And yet God still works through that to bring about his own ends. That is the resounding theme of Scripture. Not that God steps in and just says, oh, well, you know, forget the suffering. But it is that he works through it. And this is actually what astounds Paul in Romans, when he's sort of walking the reader back through Israel's history to show God's sovereignty and how he orchestrates events to bring about his own ends. And he sort of works himself up to that, what we would call a doxology. And this is coming out of Romans chapter 8 and Romans chapter 9 and this idea. He sort of works himself up to say, I cannot even begin to fathom the mind of God and how he has worked these events that should, I mean, the death of the Messiah himself, how he works these events to his ends. It sort of drives Paul to bended knee, which is what I think it should do for us. And so the moment, the film really ends, it's really sort of a good moment where Zac Efron's character, his Kevin, is sort of watching his two sons play in the yard. And, you know, it sort of hits him that, you know, his sons, who are brothers, are playing, and he doesn't have any brothers left. He's watching them, and it sort of all comes rushing back to him, and he finally breaks down. And his kids are like very confused, right? Because they've never seen this, because, you know, and he even tries to, you know, tell them, you know, your kids aren't supposed to see their father like this, and this sort of thing. But the kids sort of step into it, and they're like, well, you know, we'll, and very innocently, because they're young, they're like, well, you know, daddy, we'll be your new brothers, type thing. And charting the course of Kevin's emotional journey in the film is where the real value lies in this movie. You know, you are not going to get to Jesus from watching this film, but you absolutely can start having conversations about it. Because I think anyone who is being honest with themselves will have moments like that in life, if they haven't already. So very worthwhile film in that regard.
It is a very intense film, so I would say that going in. Do you think it's a film that all Christians could see?
No. No, I don't. I think...
There's no nudity, or, well, they do walk around in their underwear a lot, but I guess
they do.
There's no nudity, like sexuality nudity. There is one brief implied scene between the character and his then girlfriend to become his wife, but there's nothing like that, and very little language, but it is very dark.
Yeah, and there's very little language, but, you know, but again, it's not the kind of film that all people can see. And to be honest, it's not made for all kinds of people. In fact, I'm astounded that this film was released at Christmas, to be honest, because this is not the Hallmark movie. It is the antidote to the Hallmark movie in a lot of ways. But I will point out, just because you mentioned it, the whole, like, the walking around in your underwear kind of thing, that is such that culture, the culture that's portrayed in this film. So it's little things like that that to the outsider, and rightly so, you should sit there and go, that's weird. Like, isn't it a little odd that you're all that comfortable with each other? In the 80s, in the 70s, in that particular culture, the vestiges of which I grew up in, it's really not that odd for them. Not saying that objectively it isn't. I think part of coming out of that culture is realizing that, wait a minute, we're very strange, and this is not how normal people live. It is part of the beast. But you know, it never seems to go away. It's like the Eagle song. They stab it with their steely knives, but they just can't kill the beast. That's all part of the warp and woof of that world. And it's when you're in it, you don't think about it. But if you just get out of it for a second and look back, it's wildly uncomfortable. So no, I don't think it's the kind of film that all Christians can watch or even should watch, not because it's profane in a sense, but just because it's a tough film to sit through. It's a very tough film to sit through. I was actually having dinner earlier this week with a local professional wrestler, and he had seen the film. He caught it at the premiere, and we were talking about it. And he said, you know, when it started, the theater was, you know, pretty lively. And he said, and once they started to realize what the movie was about, once the brothers started dying, he said it was silent, just silent, because it's just one thing after another. So no, I don't think it's the kind of thing that everybody should go to, but I do think there are worse films that you could watch.
And I do think for those who can watch it and maybe know of people that can that have seen it, there really is something there to talk about what the Bible teaches of a theology of suffering. Because like you said, most American Christians, I guess because of our own, you know, particular history as a country, expect that, you know, everything is always going to be successful. So if you're a Christian, you will be successful. Nothing harm will come to you and that kind of thing. And it could be because of the Word of Faith movement that we have, or even just we've covered in the Christian Research Journal, this movement, kind of a secular Word of Faith movement of manifesting, that every day you say these things and you manifest, you know, your success, that no suffering will come to you. So it is something that seems almost like here are these guys at that time at the top of their game, so to speak, in their profession before it started. You see the kind of the demise of their small town wrestling kind of arena and area as, you know, some of the big guys start moving in. But before that, how successful it was. And one of the brothers goes to overseas to do wrestling. I mean, he started to be known worldwide type of thing, that in the midst of this, that didn't necessarily mean they were not going to face suffering.
Yeah. The American model of Christianity, which is so entrenched here, right? I talk with my students about this quite often. My class, we don't have textbooks, right? I don't do textbooks. I don't really care about what, you know, such and such says Paul is talking about. I tell the kids, I want you to be able to tell me what Paul is talking about. So our only text is scripture. And, you know, reading some of what Paul says, reading James, if you think Paul is direct, read James. I mean, he goes after the let's call it the health and wealth idea more than Paul. I mean, James is, you don't pull punches about it. But when you read these writings of these early Christians, I mean, it really flies in the face of so much of what I was even taught by really well-meaning Christians growing up. So much of what I hear from really well-meaning Christians on Sunday mornings in pulpits, what Paul is saying about suffering, and not just suffering, but enduring suffering, like the hymn, Christ, life is worth the living because he lives. It's sort of antithetical the way that it's written, but it's a really interesting little line I've always liked. That's really what Paul is driving at, that life is worth enduring the suffering because Christ has suffered and is suffering with you, and you are suffering with him. Christ has suffered, Christ endured, and you can too. So suffering is, it's a centerpiece of this movie. And unfortunately, I don't think it's a centerpiece in many Christians' lives. And what I don't mean is that Christians aren't suffering and they should. That's not at all what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that I find Christians don't have categories for it. Or they become Job's friends. Well, you're suffering. Well, then you must have done something wrong. Oh, you're suffering, so God is punishing you. No. that was the theology of the Pharisees. That was the theology of Job's friends. That was the theology of the Judaizers in the New Testament. This is what they're disparaging Paul about in Romans. I mean, you can practically hear the Judaizer in the different churches of the New Testament, you know, telling the Gentiles, well, why would you want to follow Paul? He's beaten into every town he goes into. He doesn't really know the law. In fact, what he kind of is telling you to do is just ignore the law. It doesn't matter. And look at him. He ends up in jail because God's punishing him for what he's doing. He never has any money. He never has anything to eat. He's always got to go out there and make tents in order to supply for himself. Why would you listen to Paul? And of course, Paul is the guy who says, listen, I don't care if an angel shows up. If somebody tells you something that didn't come from me or the apostles, let that person be accursed. Which is very strong language, very strong language. And suffering is a major, major theme of the New Testament epistles. And in fact, it's sort of the crux of it. A film like this can, for a Christian, provides a great opportunity, especially someone who's interested in cultural apologetics. And you shouldn't waste it, is my point.
One question I want to ask you is about their mother, because at the beginning, the book ends that kind of repeat the same dialogue about what their dad had taught them and that their mother, their faith was from their mom. It seems that she, in one sense, was hands off with how their dad and, you know, Kevin has said that it's very accurate portrayal of his dad in some senses. It's like she didn't really step into she would sit there very stoically at the dinner table in those scenes and would never step into kind of his direction of his sons. And even when the brothers had conflict, as portrayed in the movie, she would say, well, you work it out with your brother. And in some sense, there was a sense of disappointment with that because they were looking to their mom, maybe because of her faith. And yet she was a little bit hands off, or portrayed that way anyway in the film.
Again, when you know the culture that is being portrayed, this sort of, you know, Southern good old boy, you know, and I say this with some affection because this is my background, but this sort of Southern good old boy, you know, type of faith, her response is spot on. I actually don't know. I've not read anything, and I feel like I've read quite a bit about this, but I've not really read anything that focuses on Doris. They call her Dottie in the movie. Her name is Doris Atkinson. There's not a ton of information out there. There's probably some stuff that Kevin has remarked on about how his mother was, but I never question the portrayal because it is so exactly what I know. That's the father and those are the sons, and the father handles the sons, and the sons have, you know, the son has brothers. And so when the son has a question, he talks to his brothers about it because it's improper to talk to one's mother about these things. And yet you can cruise into the kitchen in your underwear. and just get sort of a snide remark from her, and nothing really, you know, changes too much about it. See, it's paradoxical in a lot of ways. It's what, when my sister and I talk about this, we sort of laugh about it, and we call it, well, we call it a double standard. I'll say it that way. We have some words for it, but it's a kind of double standard. This holier than thou, very prim, very put together. We don't show emotion, which is something you'll notice about the whole family, right? They don't show emotion, because why would you? Because after all, there is a God, and so there's no need for emotion. That sort of, you know, assumption. She never steps in. She never gets in the way. And even there's the scene, I think it's early in the film that you're referencing, where Kevin even goes to her and says, you need to talk to Dad about not being so hard on one of the kids. You need to talk to him. And, you know, her response is very hands off. You know, she's not going to, because it's not her place. It's the father handles that with the sons. And she handles, compartmentalizes. Everything is compartmentalized. Unfortunately, but that portrayal is one I didn't question, because I can completely see it. I've seen it all my life.
And it seems though there's a little change with her character at the end, or at least how the filmmakers portray her, because at the end, you know, after all these various deaths, and now it's just the two of them, they're empty nesting at this point. And he comes in, and, you know, there's scene after scene where she makes these giant meals of, you know, ribs and bacon and eggs and, you know, biscuits and that kind of thing. And she's there and she's painting, and he says, well, where's dinner? And she said, I didn't make any, which is really funny to me, because her whole time, that's how she's been portrayed, as she just kind of is there keeping of the home, but not even stepping into the relationships between her husband and their sons.
Yeah. That's sort of the film's way of closing her arc. Again, I would assume that's apocryphal. But it is a really sort of a good scene, because it unfolds sort of right after Kevin has his big moment of catharsis with him, where Fritz comes into the house, and she's almost in a daze. I mean, she's out of it the whole movie in a way, but, you know, it's almost like she's doing what she wants to do, but she's so detached from reality, she don't even know what's happening. You know, he comes in expecting dinner, and she's just, I just decided I'm not going to make any. And because, you know, this is the Southern culture, because you always respect the lady, Fritz doesn't say anything, which I when I saw it, I thought that was fascinating. He doesn't say anything. He just sits down. And he's not going to make a big deal about it, because, you know, she's technically not doing anything wrong. But that's sort of the way the film closes her arc. That's her way of saying, you know, I'm done with this. Clearly your way has not worked. We've lost pretty much all of our children. I'm done. But, you know, as far as I know, they stuck together. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, she died, I want to say, in the 80s, the late 80s. Oh, don't quote me on that.
He died fairly young. He wasn't even 70 years old when he died, when he died. And then at the end, they have some kind of like, here's where they all are now. And they show Kevin and his wife that's portrayed. They've been married for 60-something years, 61 years.
Yeah.
And like but then again, I wondered about that, because they're like, well, he had moved, I mean, in real life, he had moved to Hawaii, but then recently in this 2023, he had been living there for decades and moved his whole family back to Texas, bought some big plot of land, and everyone lives there in Texas with him. So it's kind of like super interesting, you know, how he was so close to his brothers, but then like in real life, his own sons, their kids, all the grandkids, they all live on the same piece of property as their dad.
Listen, that... that is this culture.
It says at the end, they all live in a ranch, the grandkids, yeah, the kids. Yeah. And that that brought an audible, like, people seemed excited about that, you know, in the theater where I was sitting, and they're like, oh, you know.
Yeah, and so you see what's interesting about that is I, again, this is such that culture, right? I call it the clan. So this is how it is back home, right? You,
the idea is that the family has a plot of land or several plots of land. The children grow up through high school. They're obviously not going to leave, because why would you want to leave? Your whole family's there. And so you just stay on a piece of land, or you build a house on a piece of land and you live there. I call it, you know, it's the clan mentality. And in my neck of the woods, the West Virginia, Kentucky area, it all sort of has its roots in the Scotch-Irish who settled the area, right? The idea of the clan and doing it that way. But I sort of jokingly say that they all live in compounds, right? It was just, it's whole families and the cousins, you know, just the door over. If you want dinner, you don't cook it. You go next door to mom and dad's and they cook it for you, even if you're 40 years old. I mean, that's just the way things are. So when the film, you know, had that at the end, and I had read recently that this is sort of what Kevin was doing. On one sense, I guess someone looks at that and goes, oh, that's so sweet. See, that's almost the sentimentality that I'm talking about. No. It's repeating the cycle. It's doing it over again. It's going back to what you know, because it's just what you know, which is the real tragedy of the piece, really. Even the emotional journey that is gone on, you're still just right back doing what you know to do, because it's what you grew up in and it's just what you know. And right or wrong doesn't really factor into the equation, which is fascinating. Fascinating.
I don't know if I'd say it's ironic, but when you see that at the end, and then I did look up, you know, in preparation for this podcast, I read a few articles about their family and their life, and I found out that some of his sons were wrestlers. It's like, okay, but now you're actually doing the same thing. You lost your brothers, who were everything to you, as the film portrays it. Then now your whole entire family's back in Texas, including your sons and all their children. So your grandchildren. So it's this huge, giant, like you said, clan. They had a picture of them, you know, a couple generations all living together. And they're also wrestling. So, I mean, they're not all wrestling now, but there was a season of them also wrestling. So I thought that was just kind of interesting.
Bingo. It's the kind of thing that you almost can't make up, right? The irony of it. It sounds like something that's written in a movie, but it's not. And that, I think, is one of the most profound things about this culture, the culture we're talking about, whatever you want to call that. I try not to stick too many labels on it because it cues up too many things in people's minds. But that particular brand of Christianity, that particular brand of family and you know, the down home, just me, you know, mom and pops and that kind of stuff. There is an irony to it that is lost on the people who are in it. I mean, I look at my own family for this. They are caricatures in a play, and they do the things that they're supposed to, because it's like a pre-written script. And you know, it took me years. It took me meeting other people. I mean, it took me living with my friends and their families for a period of time to realize, wait a minute, we're the freaks. we're the backwards ones, and we're in church every Sunday. And we're the ones who are very strange and out of touch with reality here. I remember looking back on it and trying to have these conversations with some of my family members and realizing this is a waste of time, because you don't even have categories for what it is that you do. You don't even have categories for the way that you think. You do things and say things and be a certain way because it's like someone has told you that's how you're supposed to be. And there, it really takes a sense of irony to see it. You have to have a bit of a sense of irony. I do believe that a sense of irony is absolutely salvific. Jesus Christ was a master of sarcasm, and Yahweh has a cutting sense of irony. So having a sense of irony, having a sense of humor, is actually extremely important, because these people tend to have none of it. And I will point out, you know, when you look at the way Fritz is portrayed, the man does not have a humorous bone in his body. He has that one very sweet moment with his wife. Like you said, when they're becoming empty nesters, I think it's Kevin's wedding. They have that moment of conversation, that really sort of touching moment between them. But the man doesn't have a sense of humor about him at all. And he takes himself and his situation and wrestling with all the seriousness of the world. And you really see the damage that does. So, yeah, it's just part of that particular type of weirdly American Christian Southern subculture that is still alive and kicking today.
Yes, it is very fascinating. I would say that what is interesting to me is how popular that this particular form of entertainment is. It's just been so, people say, well, professional football and all those kinds of things and college football, which is big, but this is just as big. I mean, Vince McMahon has been made so much money off of this. He is worth more than $2.5 billion individually himself, as listed by Forbes. So it's very popular and people are making a lot of money. And so, I mean, I can't imagine. It seems so visceral to me. Like, why would people want to watch this? But at the same time, people go to football games and watch that, and that's violent too. So I guess it's just in a different, kind of arena than professional football, but I guess it could be similar. And so I just wonder, why would people kind of see this and go to professional wrestling matches and follow all this? But not just that, I think because there is a sense of community and it started where it's been handed down, kind of like, people will say, oh, my dad was an XYZ football or baseball fan. So that's why I don't even live in that state, but that's why I'm a, Mets fan or a Red Sox fan or whatever, fill in the blank, whatever their team is. And so I'm just surprised at the popularity of professional wrestling.
Yeah, it's a billion-dollar industry. And I will say, though, and it's also worth pointing this out, just because WWE is sort of the one that everyone knows, there are a lot of local promotions. And this is where I've sort of done my own research and spent my own time just learning about the craft and that kind of a thing to write about it. There are a ton of local promotions. It's not quite what the territories used to be, but smaller venues where when you attend them, and I've attended a handful of them, you'll start to see the same faces. It really is a kind of community. It's a kind of, it has a lot of similarities to a church service, to be honest with you. And I wrote on that in another publication, but there's a lot of overlap. And I also want to point out, a lot of people watch it and think, well, why would anyone sort of the underlying, because I've heard this a lot from different people, the underlying sort of snobbishness I will sometimes hear is, well, it's mindless. How can somebody watch that? Well, simple. There's something in filmmaking we call a suspension of disbelief. That is, when you go into a movie, you know you're being taken for a ride and that it's fake, but you just sort of forget that for a span of 2 hours. Wrestling is the same way. You walk in to go to a show and you know you're being taken for a ride, but you just sort of forget that and roll with it for 2 hours. And it's not, listen, it ain't mindless people. This is not just brutes up there. I mean, I'll never forget when I was in high school, I knew, the characters, like Undertaker and Kane in wrestling. Well, I went to an economics seminar that the school took me to, and there stood Glenn Jacobs giving a lecture in a suit. Glenn Jacobs is Kane, this, masked wrestler, giant machine type of character standing there in a suit lecturing on economics. And now he's the mayor of Knox County, Tennessee. You're really going to struggle to say that's a mindless guy. This local professional wrestler who's getting some attention that I was at dinner with, class, CLAS. This guy is a psychologist. He's a doctor, and he wrestles. I mean, these are not, brainless people. It's a form of entertainment. And they're very intelligent. It really takes a very creative edge to go out there and do this kind of thing. Whether you're a face or a heel, a good guy or a bad guy, the enemy in this industry is apathy. The last thing you want to do is go out there and have an audience go, oh, we didn't think you were interesting at all. No, you want them to either love you or hate you. And that's what takes you places. So it's just a form of entertainment. And especially in the local promotions, it's still very analog. They don't have all the pyrotechnics or the broadcasting. It's like going to a play for a lot of people.
Well, on a much lighter note, I hope, than this intense conversation about suffering and wrestling and those kinds of subjects, what is a word you would like to describe for your 2024? I might have asked you that last year, because this coming weekend, it's going to be the new year.
Vacation.
Did you say that last year?
Well, it didn't work out this year, so we're gonna roll it over to next year. Vacation next year.
Okay. Well, thank you again for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Today's guest was Cole Brigette, and we were discussing the film The Iron Claw, which is in theaters now. And you can read his online feature-length cultural apologetics film review, and it is called Painkiller, a review of The Iron Claw, and you can read it for free at our website, equip.org. Stay connected with the Christian Research Institute and all the new content we have coming your way. The best way to do that is to head on over to our website, equip.org. There you will find thousands of free resources right at your fingertips, from articles to video to audio, and it's all for free. You'll find our podcasts hosted there, as well as the Bible Answer Man broadcast, which is hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and streams live every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. In addition, you don't want to miss out on subscribing to Hank Unplugged, which is the podcast of Hank Hanegraaff. And it's in that podcast he has really in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people. And in addition, he has a new series on his podcast feed called Hank Unplugged Shorts, which Hank goes into the headlines in the mainstream media and refutes a lot of those cultural issues that we have in these short podcast episodes. And there's quite a few of them. You don't want to miss out on them. Now, if you want to find some of this at other places where it's all in one place, really subscribe to our YouTube channel. It's a great way to get all of our content there, our podcasts there, and different individual questions theologically that people have that Hank answers at our YouTube channel. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, I don't know how to subscribe to YouTube. I don't have a YouTube account. Well, actually, you might just have a YouTube account. If you have a Gmail address, you have a YouTube account. Just log into YouTube with your Gmail address and search for Bible Answer Man channel, and please become one of our subscribers. In addition, if you see that bell icon right there on our front page, please click that. And every time that we have new content, you will receive a notification that new content is up on our channel for you to be able to consume. So thank you so much for the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute. We are grateful for you listening and reading and watching.